Oh, say can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations where our children can play in a world without war where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation where the rivers run clean through the forests of green where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom. Oh, say do our hearts sing out for harmony and love forever on the planet of our blessed with peace on earth.
Hello, and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at AccessSacramento.org. Today's program includes The War Over Climate with Eric Pooley and Eli Kintish from August 18, 2010. Francesca Viana talks with Eric Pooley about the politics of climate change. His book is The Climate War, True Believers, Power Brokers, and the Fight to Save the Earth. Also, Eli Kintish talks about geoengineering. His book is Hacking the Planet, Science's Best Hope or Worst Nightmare for Averting Climate Catastrophe. This is 59 Minutes. And then after that, Scott Horton interviews Andrew Basevich from August 9, 2010. Andrew Basevich is a professor of international relations at Boston University and the author of Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. He discusses the bipartisan business of war making, the destructive patriotism of Washington power elite, and why military power is useless at affecting positive social change. This is 9 minutes. And then after that, from Living on Earth, on October 1st, 2010, Yellow Dirt, Navajo country provided a significant share of America's Cold War uranium, but when the mining companies walked away, no one told the people not to build houses out of the material left behind. This is also 9 minutes.
The War Over Climate.
So my book follows the battle to get this done. And when I started this, Francesca, I thought I was going to be writing a story with a happy ending, frankly, that it would be the story of how we finally took the first step. A funny thing happened on the way to the presidential signing ceremony, and we didn't take that first step.
That's journalist Eric Pooley. We talked to him about the politics of climate change. His book is The Climate War. And what's next on the climate? Will we have to re-engineer the planet to survive? Or will the cure be worse than the disease?
Geoengineering may be something that could be done fairly cheaply, at least initially. I don't think we know quite what the costs would be in terms of the impact on the environment.
That's Eli Kintish. We talked to him about his book, Hacking the Planet, Science's Best Hope or Worst Nightmare for Averting Climate Catastrophe. That's all coming up on Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Record heat in Russia with forest fires raging out of control. Record floods in Pakistan, 20 million people affected. Floods and mudslides in China, 1,200 people dead there. And that's just in 1 week. And more worries. Russia's announced a 30% drop in wheat production and has cut off all wheat exports. From leading climate scientists to Russian President Medvedev, all this havoc is being tied to climate change. But the U.S. Senate hasn't gotten a memo from Mother Nature. It looked like it might happen. Last year, the House passed the Waxman-Markey climate bill. While it wasn't enough to cool the climate, it was a start. But that start is now dead in the water for the foreseeable future. My guest, Eric Pooley, has written a spellbinding political thriller about who killed the climate bill and how they did it. It's called The Climate War. I met with Eric Pooley on a scorching day in New York City, one of many this summer. It was at the Bloomberg building where Pooley works as deputy editor of Business Week. Eric Pooley, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
The personalities and the issues that have framed the war over climate policy is the subject of your book. Let's start with one side of that climate war, the deny and delay movement, as you call them. Could you first tell us who are they and who's behind them?
Well, when I set out to write this book, I didn't expect that that would be a big part of the story because I thought that the debate was shifting from the science to the politics and economics. In other words, from whether climate change was real to what we were going to do about it. But the deny and delay crowd are dedicated to sowing doubt and confusion on this issue, and they've done an extremely good job and have been very persistent. So that question about whether it's really happening or not continues to be a source of real power. It's derailed, or at least helped to derail legislation, because there's about a third of the country that is not at all sure that this is really happening. That didn't happen by accident. That's the result of a concerted effort on the part of paid professional public relations people. The one that I focus on most is a man named Myron Ebell. He's director of global warming policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Now, the CEI is a conservative think tank in Washington that opposes taxation and regulation of any kind. And it's been part of this movement that's been driven by ideology, anti-tax and anti-regulatory zeal to deny the fact of global warming. These are people whose thinking moves from effect to cause. They hate the proposed solutions. They hate the idea of regulating the energy economy. They hate the idea of transitioning from dirty to clean fuels. Not incidentally, they get a lot of funding from the fossil fuel companies. And they are dedicated to a two-front war. One front is the science, and they claim that the jury is still out over whether this is happening. They have a different argument every day. They used to say that there was no global warming. When it became very clear that there was, they retreated to a point where now they say, well, it's happening, but man is not the cause. They argue that it's natural variation or that it's sunspots or that if it is happening, we can't do anything about it. They have a different argument depending on the day of the week, sometimes it seems. But it's always consistent that whatever's going on, we shouldn't do anything about it. That's clearly their consistent conclusion. And then the other front that they're fighting on is over the economics. They say that if we do anything about it, it'll break the bank, destroy the economy, drive the price of electricity up, kill jobs, move them to China. The usual scare tactics that you hear from industry anytime a new environmental regulation is proposed.
Now, that last one, the economics, has been getting a lot of play recently, although, as you point out, I'd say probably all of those arguments have been, surprisingly, some of them being resurrected after having been soundly defeated. You call that the big lie of the climate debate. I'd like to go into this a little bit more deeply later on, but if you could just lay that out for us right now, just some of the broad outline of why that is such a big lie.
The big lie of the climate debate is the notion that the economy and the environment need to be in opposition. In other words, that if you do something good for the environment, you're going to do something bad for the economy. This is an argument that dates back to Ronald Reagan, and it's obsolete now because the fact is we need to do something good for the economy that's also good for the climate and the environment, and that's transition from dirty fuels to clean fuels. Now, that's not to say that there won't be any short-term costs associated with this transition. Clearly, there will. There's always a great churn in the American economy, and my day job is deputy editor of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, so I'm intimately familiar with economic theory and the churn of a vibrant, changing, ever-evolving American economy. It's like a great river, and it's what the economic theorists call creative destruction. As we move towards new technologies and new industries, older ones get left behind. We're not using buggy whips anymore, and the print media industry is embattled. These things happen as economies go on, and new economies are created. So that's the larger frame. In the energy sphere, we need to move from dirty fuels that have sustained our prosperity and made it possible for the last century or more to cleaner fuels that can sustain our prosperity and make it possible for centuries into the future. Now, as we make this transition, there are going to be winners and losers. And what we have here is the people who think they're going to be the losers trying to prevent the transition from taking place. So they cast this false choice, if you will, between the environment and the economy. They say if we choose the environment, if we choose to do something about climate change, then our beloved American economy is going to crash. That couldn't be further from the truth. There are new industries waiting to be born. There are new industries waiting to create tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of American jobs. All we need to do is level the playing field, take away the subsidies that the fossil fuel industries have long enjoyed, and put a price on carbon, close the carbon loophole that has prevented us from accelerating the transition to clean energies. Now, closing the carbon loophole is really what my book is about. That's what the fight is over. Putting a price on carbon, this great market failure in all of our energy markets around the world that has allowed anybody who wants to spew global warming pollution into the atmosphere for free. And the argument here is that it shouldn't be free. There ought to be a small fee placed on that. And how do you place that small fee? Well, by creating something called carbon permits or carbon allowances, where if you want to be a major league polluter, you have to buy one for each ton of CO2 that you're going to be spewing into the atmosphere. So that is the heart of it. It's putting a mandatory declining cap on carbon emissions. And so far, it's something that the United States Senate has been unwilling to do. So my book follows the battle to get this done. And when I started this, Francesca, I thought I was going to be writing a story with a happy ending, frankly, that it would be the story of how we finally took the first step. A funny thing happened on the way to the presidential signing ceremony, and we didn't take that first step. We managed to pass the bill in the House of Representatives, and then the Senate and the president decided that they weren't willing to fight it. They didn't want to go to the mat for this bill in 2009 or 2010. And just a week ago, the Senate pulled the plug on the latest attempt to get something done. The president did not make so much as a peep about it, and they're all still claiming that they're going to be doing it someday, but they keep kicking the can down the road. And at this point, it's a very old can, very battered from many kicks, and a very long road, and we're not making a lot of progress.
I guess a question that came to my mind when that bill failed, and also after reading your excellent piece on that, on why the bill failed, when was that again?
I wrote that for the Yale Environment 360 website. I believe it's www.yalee360.org.
Yes, and we'll link to that writer's voice. And we're talking with Eric Pooley. He's the author of The Climate War, True Believers, Power Brokers, and the Fight to Save the Earth. We're talking about the war over climate policy. So my question that really came up is, why does the fossil fuel lobby have so much greater power than all the other U.S. businesses that stand to gain from this or stand to lose from catastrophic climate change?
Well, that's a great question. And the happy thing that's happened in the last couple of years have been a lot of very big, profitable, powerful companies that have stepped forward and said, we have to do this. It's time to put a cap on carbon and a time to accelerate the transition to clean energy. And I'm talking about companies like General Electric and DuPont and Alcoa. And that has broken the de facto veto that big business has held over climate legislation for a decade. However, it wasn't enough to get the job done. The fossil fuel companies are intensely powerful, and the manufacturers are very powerful, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and all of the companies represented there are powerful, and they are still blocking the way forward. Let's break it down. Inside the electric utility industry, which is the sort of sharp tip of the spear here, because that's probably where we'll begin the regulatory push, there are companies who have already decarbonized. They're already getting a lot of their power from hydro, from nuclear, and beginning to get a lot more of it from solar and wind. And they are saying, yes, let's cap carbon, let's accelerate. Then there are utilities that are getting their energy still from coal and natural gas. And they're saying, no, let's not do this. And it's really the coal-based utilities that have been dragging their heels and preventing change in tandem with the oil companies and the National Association of Manufacturers and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, two big, powerful industry lobbies that have been opposed to doing this. They have a lot of money to spend. They have a lot of clout on Capitol Hill, and there are about a dozen senators, either from states that get a lot of their electricity from coal or states that produce coal, who have been blocking the way forward. And the politics inside the Senate, as you know, you need 60 votes to do anything. So even if we have a slight majority, 50 or 52 people in the Senate who are willing to vote for this, that's not enough. We need to get to 60 to get it done. And so far, we have not been able to do that. Now, why haven't we been able to? I believe the most important reason is that the President of the United States has not gotten in there and fought for a bill. Obama has done a lot on climate, especially in the Department of Energy. They've spent billions of dollars to accelerate electric vehicle production, battery factories in the U.S. There are 17 new electric vehicle battery factories up and running or under construction in the state of Michigan alone. So that's one of the things Obama has done. He's also put through new fuel efficiency standards that reduce emissions from car tailpipes, and he's moved the EPA towards stationary regulation of factories and power plants that's supposed to kick in next year, although that's going to be another big battle. So don't get me wrong. The president has done a lot, and he's done more than any president in history. Where he has fallen down has been on the single most important thing, putting a price on carbon through a cap. And there, he has talked a good game, but the truth is he has not stepped up. He has not put his considerable power behind a specific piece of legislation. He has not told the Senate what he wants, and he has not led on three levels. The level of sustained, deep communication to the American people, explaining why we need to do this, why we need to transition to clean energy, and how we're going to get it done, why a carbon cap is so important. He hasn't really made that case. He's made it intermittently, usually on a Tuesday afternoon in a visit to a solar factory that doesn't get a lot of attention. When he did his Oval Office speech to the nation after the BP oil spill, he missed an enormous opportunity to tell people what we need to do and why. He actually said, we don't know precisely how we're going to get there. We have a roadmap, but we need to share it with people. And the president chose not to. So that was a bitter disappointment to the heroic people who have been campaigning for climate legislation at the federal level. So communication is one place where Obama has not stepped up. Another is, as I mentioned, policy, getting deeply engaged with the Senate on a particular piece of policy. And the third is good old-fashioned politicking and bending some arms to try to get those votes. You know, when we passed the bill in the House a year ago, Nancy Pelosi and Henry Waxman brought the bill to the House floor without having the votes in place, and they forced the president's hand. And for a week or 10 days, Obama whipped that vote, and he really worked hard, and they won. Now the president and his political advisors have been saying, well, we don't have the votes in the Senate, so we're not going to take it to the floor. Well, we didn't have them in the House either, and we got there because we went for it. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you say you don't have the votes, you're not going to have the votes. And look, I know the Senate is harder than the House. It's very difficult to get there. It's not something that you can do in a week or even a month. That takes sustained effort from the president, and so far, he's not been willing to do it.
Why didn't Obama do this?
Well, Obama gets the climate threat, and he wants to do it. He thinks that the time is wrong politically. And I don't have to tell anybody what a tough time it's been for the American economy, how many folks are out of work, and how hard it is to talk about anything that would impose further short-term costs on the American people. The costs that we're talking about, the cost of imposing a cap on carbon, are very, very low. According to the EPA and the Congressional Budget Office and all of the best academic studies, we're talking about maybe $70 to $140 a year in additional costs to a household, middle-income household, by 2030. Now, that's not a lot of money. What's more, the low-income people would be completely shielded from these costs because there are really smart people creating mechanisms that make sure that there's a cushion for any low-income American. In fact, would come out ahead from these bills because they'd be given rebates that would make sure that they don't incur any additional costs. So these are scare tactics, but they're scare tactics that the administration apparently thinks are so effective that they're not willing to take them on. And it's a shame because we know that the high growth path into the future, the long-term upside is so great from getting on this clean energy trail that we really have no reason not to do it. And in fact, I just wrote a piece for Business Week last week, which makes the argument that we're already losing and may even have lost the clean energy race to China. There is more investment, private investment, going into clean energy in China than going into the U.S. and Europe combined. And China is spending $9 billion a month on clean energy technology, and it plans to spend hundreds of billions of dollars over the next decade to accelerate these. If we want to keep up with the Chinese, we need a market. We need a price on carbon. The president gets this. His economic advisors have talked about a scissors approach to economic recovery. A scissors has two blades. The first blade was the stimulus package, and there was about $60 or $70 billion that went into clean energy in the stimulus package. The second blade of the scissors would be the cap, and that would bring a lot of private investment off the sidelines. But we haven't done the cap yet, so our scissors is missing a blade.
Tell us more now about cap and trade. You know, the other policy has been a carbon tax. There's been a controversy between the two. In your book, Eric Pooley, The Climate War, I think you give probably the clearest explanation of what the cap actually does, what cap and trade does, which has been something that a lot in the environmental community have looked upon with a certain degree of skepticism.
It's true. The cap and the idea of cap and trade has been demonized by both the right and the left. And it's a lot of folks think it's really complicated. It's actually pretty simple if you break it down into two parts. The part that really matters is the cap. That's the mandatory declining limit on carbon pollution. We measure it. We say this is how much we can emit in a year, and we ratchet that down over time. The part that's been most demonized and most misunderstood is the trade. That's really a way to manage costs. It's a way to keep costs down for the companies that have to clean up their act. And there are different ways of doing the trade. And frankly, it's all about politics when you get to the trade part. It's all about costs and arguing over who bears the cost. The cap is the important part, and that's what we need to get done. The trade is whatever approach we can get the most votes to get this thing through. Whether it's a cap and dividend approach where you rebate all the money back to Americans, or whether it's a trade approach where you sell allowances and let them be traded between major emitters, or whether it's a allowance auction approach where you sell some of the allowances and you give other allowances for free to the emitters with the proviso that they have to pass on the savings to their customers. I talked earlier about some of the smart ideas for cushioning folks from the effect of this, and that's one of the smart ideas. This has been on the left sold as a windfall for polluters, where in fact, if the law says that the polluters have to pass on their savings to their customers, it's not a windfall. But, you know, we can debate those various approaches, and we can also debate a carbon tax, and I would be happy with any of those approaches. My problem is that the left spends all its time arguing over what's better. The right spends all its time demonizing the approach that came the closest to passing, and as a result, we got nothing done.
We'll be right back. But now for something completely different.